Okay, today, as promised, we were going to talk about, I'm going to give you kind of a, what I think is an answer to how some of the stuff that we've been talking about over the last couple of weeks could happen. This is, none of what's up here is derived deductively from necessity, so this, nothing that I'm saying here has to be the way that it is. But when talking about just the general problem of evil, of how is it that the world that we live in right now is clearly has some bad things going on in it, and in some places, and sometimes some very, very bad things. And one of the main questions a lot of skeptics and questioners, and even Christians, have about Christianity in total is, how can a God be both all-loving and all-powerful, and yet we see this world is clearly kind of jacked up, we might say, is one way of putting it. So, is this the kind of world? Another way of thinking of it is, you'll hear people who are very, very much embroiled in, entwined in, working with the scientific method, where the scientific method is one that says, you know, make a prediction and then do some testing and see how the data fit it. They are likely to frame the question this way: is this the kind of world you would expect if there was a perfect, all-loving, omnipotent God behind it? And many people conclude, no, this world is too broken. There's too much evil, or the fact of evil at all seems to suggest that God is either not clever enough or not powerful enough to get it done. So I would like to answer the question for you today, as to the best of my ability, but this is very much going to be heavily dependent on your feedback. Why? I've got in draft a very rough, incomplete draft, kind of an academic paper in this direction. I really want to do a popular one in this direction, and y'all who can stand with a foot in both worlds can help me out understand how to change. This is, I've got an outline form. I've just sent it out on the Facebook page in case anybody wants to look at it on their own device as well. That is going to give an answer to one of two kinds of the problems of evil. One of them is the logical problem of evil, which, to my understanding, is not held by anybody anymore. Nobody thinks there's a logical problem of evil anymore. The logical problem of evil is a very narrowly defined problem that says it is not possible that there be evil in the world if there is an all-good, all-loving, all-powerful God. Somebody, that one was relatively easily solved by somebody just saying, if it's even possible that that God has a good reason for permitting evil, then this isn't a logical problem anymore. And people who were proponents of the logical problem of evil in the literature have said, yep, that's correct. So it's not strictly, you know, logically impossible. It's not even generally broadly logically impossible. So now it's a probabilistic problem of evil. Okay, well, yeah, that's not impossible that God has a reason for it, but it's just very, very unlikely. And, I mean, come on, he's God. How come he couldn't do something better? So today's articulation, I apologize, is it's supposed to be a little bit in transmit mode. However, this is solid ground. So anytime you want, raise your hand. Don't even raise your hand. Jump in and hit it, attack it, anything that you want to. So I can either just give it, or, and if you want, we'll roll that way. But if not, anytime you see an objection, anything you want to talk about, fire away. Well, nobody will take offense to that here. There's something that will be interesting as well, I think, is that there is, I've got some data behind this one. I think I mentioned it last time. I've got a 1,000-person study, and I'll show you the results of it here. And I think that it's, even if nothing else that you hear today is worthwhile, I think that survey was very interesting. So you might be interested in that one. So some of this is in a little bit of logic keys. I know that we'll change it a little bit. But we're going to talk about what is the greatest possible world. Leibniz, the famous philosopher, mathematician, etc., said that we are living in the best of all possible worlds, which is a head-scratcher for most people. They're like, how could this possibly be the best of all possible worlds? This is trying to make the same point. I'm trying to say this is the best of all possible worlds. So one of the things you have to ask is, what do you mean by the best of all possible worlds? Because it might be an easy thing to say. Any world in which I get to do something is the best of all possible worlds. Or maybe is it a world that's completely absent evil? Is it a world that has more good in it than any other world does? Is it a world that has some ratio of good to evil? What is the best of all possible worlds? So what minimally you need for the best of all possible worlds, I think, is this. It's characterized by the greatest properties. So if you kind of rank, or if you took all the possible worlds out there, and you rank ordered them in some sort of order of merit, then the one at the top is one that would have to have the greatest properties. And what do we mean by the greatest properties? Maybe people in the past would say it this way: the good, it has the most good and the most beautiful. It is good. It is a good and beautiful world. The opposite would be an evil and ugly world. So the good and the beautiful, where beautiful isn't just a superficial judgment. This is that which is aesthetically pleasing, that which is morally pleasing. These both of these would be something that the greatest world would have. So I kind of leave the aesthetics aside for obvious reasons. You can judge that very, very much differently. It seems to be in many ways a subjective measure. So just minimally speaking, we know the world would have to be very morally good. And in fact, if it's the greatest possible world, it would have to be morally the best world out there. So what's the best moral world out there? Well, it has to have the best moral property out there. And what's the greatest moral thing in the world? I think it's probably uncontroversial to say the greatest moral thing is love. I think most people would agree love is the highest of the virtues. It's the greatest thing out there. We certainly spend an awful lot of time in pursuit of it. It's what we really want. Even if we get all the other things in the world that we want, if we don't have love, we're not happy. I think that's pretty uncontroversial. Okay? But what is love? What does it entail? What do you have to have for there to be love? So minimally speaking, you have to have at least two beings. You have to have two. And by the way, this is not meant to be in any kind of Trinitarian thought at all. So just leave that out for now. We're talking about contingent worlds, created worlds, worlds that are made. If there is a God, whether he's a unity, whether he's a Trinity, whether he's 20 beings, if he were going to create a world, what would that world have to have? So if that world's going to have love, and it has to have at least two people, because you can't have love, a love relationship. You can't have a love relationship if you've just got one person. What was I forget the name of the Greek, Pyramus and Thisbe, is that it? The guy that falls in love with his own statue kind of thing? It doesn't work. You have to have another moral being for it to be a true love relationship. So I want to say, based on just these three premises at the top, that you can probably conclude, you can infer that the greatest possible world must contain free moral beings. So why free moral beings? Why free? For the same reason, I think we've said it many times in here, I won't beat it to death, but if you can make a being that's basically just really, really smart AI, but it's deterministic, it's a robot, if you program that robot to love you back, is that really love? Or does love, by its very nature, have to be a free choice? I think we all, shotgun weddings are not free choices. Those kinds of things. Love is a choice where you choose to regard the other person as more important than yourself. You choose to, for their benefit over your own. This is a selection that requires a free will on both parts. And I want to say that, and when I say free will in here, I'm going to speak of it in the libertarian sense. The libertarian sense of free will is, maybe I'd add my own definition to the many that are out there, of something like this. A creature, a person, a being, is only free if they can make any selection from any of the logically available selections that they have. Now, that may have a knowledge limitation, right? We may say, you can choose any color you want to paint your car. And if you just don't know of the color indigo, which I'm still not sure what it is, then you might say, well, that person's will is limited. What we mean is from choices that are available to them. So or any choice that they can think of. If they can make any selection with equal valence, equal power of any choice that's available to them, that person has truly free will. Now, it doesn't mean that that thing happens. So I'll give you an easy example. You may choose to get up and walk out of the classroom. But if an asteroid comes through here right after you choose, hey, I'm going to get up and walk out. And this asteroid comes through and hits you. You didn't walk out. But you made the choice to walk out. So your will wasn't constrained there. What was constrained was your action. So the will is the choosing. The action, there may be more to it that's required. Power, ability, that kind of stuff. You may think of a guy in a wheelchair who's just been in a car accident and he wills to get up, but he can't, his legs won't move. So that's a guy who's, you might say, well, he's constrained, he's not free. No, he's free to choose to get up, he's just not free to, he doesn't have the power to make it happen. And I think sometimes we see things like people who have continual will to do stuff like that, eventually through medical practice and regeneration of nerve cells and that kind of stuff end up being able to walk, that type of thing. But the willpower would have been necessary in that case too. Okay, so libertarian free will just means you can choose any of the options out there. And so that's what I'm presupposing. And that's a heavier burden maybe than has to be carried, but that's the one that I'm going to use.
Can you just respond real fast? What do you mean by greatest of all properties?
Is there any candidate out there for something that's greater than love, that is morally greater than love? That's all I mean. And if the answer is no, I think love is the greatest moral property, then that's all I mean. If what you mean to say is, well, love and faith and truth-telling are all great properties, then is love somehow superior to them? Are they all on the same level? Well, if they're all on the same level, at least what I'm saying is that world has to have at least love in it. So maybe there are more, but in my mind, love is kind of the clear winner. If you want to be maybe try to be clever about it, I can say, well, it's never loving to be untruthful in a real and deep sense. So truth, love entails that you treat people by speaking truth to them. And so maybe I would try to tie those in together if I was making an argument for it. But I'm really just saying that there is no greater moral principle than love, or that love is at the top tier of all moral principles.
So love these days is not what you're talking about, I don't think.
Yeah, okay, good point. So what do we mean by love? Most simply put, it's a benevolent, selfless regard for someone else. It's not you are attracted to them. It's not you want to, it's not some sort of romantic idea. It's not, I say merely, it's not merely the regard of a parent for a child. It is where benevolent means you want good for them, and selfless means the reason that you want the good for them is for them, not for something of you. So maybe it benefits you to be really good to your kids because then it'll reflect well on you and people will think better of you. That might be some love in there, but it's also diluted by some sort of selfish pride or something like that. So pure love would be something that is purely good wishing and purely selfless. I'm not saying that you have to love purely only. In fact, the Bible commands us to love others as we love ourselves. So there's some sort of half and half there, or some percentage either way. But yeah, that's a good point. By love, I mean a benevolent, selfless regard for somebody else. Okay. So if that works for you, then that was what you minimally need for it. So what else might you need? What else would you expect to see in the greatest possible world? Well, I would say this, and I'll make a little bit of an argument for it. This is a world which maximizes the greatest number of free moral beings, or just people that with free will, that live in perfect love. And that's the relationship going both ways, or if there's three of you going three ways, or if there's 10 of you going, you know, 10 factorial maybe is the number of relationships in there. That may not be right. That live in, as a percentage of all free moral beings in the world. Now, here's what I mean by that. Does God, if it's as much love as you can possibly have, does that mean that to have the greatest possible world, God has to create an infinite number of people? Because that would be more and more and more. Well, I don't think that's the case. What I really think we're saying is, if you choose to make a world of 100 people, then it's the world of all the possible worlds that have 100 people in it. Maybe you get to choose the size. But of all possible worlds that have 100 people in it, it's the one that the most people, it's the possible world of that 100-person worlds, that the most of those people live in a love relationship. Maybe this subpoint makes it a little more clear. If you have a world of 10 people, a world where 7 of those people live in perfect love is greater than a world in which only 6 of those people live in perfect love. I think that's maybe obvious. Maybe I'm stating it too complexly. It's any world, a greatest possible world is a world that maximizes the amount of love as far as possible. Now, we may scratch our head and say, well, why is it the case that it's only 7 out of 10 or 6 out of 10? Is there no possible world in which everybody lives in a perfect love relationship? Okay, so let me take a brief aside from the outline here, and Randy and I actually talked about this earlier this week, and based on something he brought up, I wanted to take this slight detour off to the side and say this. Is it plausible that God can make a world of free moral beings, perfectly free people, free wills, where all of them choose to love him? All of them. Now, Pretend you're an outside observer for a second. Skylar, you're going to be my best sounding board on this one. Pretend you're an outside observer for a second. And I'm telling you, and God has built a world, and it's got 10,000 people in it. And all 10,000 of those people choose to love God and love each other. And in fact, God says, I will tell you how this works. I just want you to trust me because I'm the one who actually knows what's going on. You don't know what's going on quite yet. I'm going to teach you everything that you want to know, but in its turn. And the first thing I want you to do is forget about selfishness, forget about the fact that you're thirsty and you don't feel the other person's thirst, that you're hungry and you don't feel the other person's hunger, that kind of stuff. I want you to treat everybody else as more important than yourself. And all 10,000 of those people are like, absolutely, I'll freely and totally, completely choose to listen to you, no question about it. What's your first, and I say, see, God did that completely fairly. What's the first thing you're going to say back to me?
It sounds counter to everything we know about human nature. It doesn't, there is no example or template in the real world that you can point to and go, it's just like society X.
Yes, right. Well, they could have just done it that way, right?
Right.
And I would say, so a great first, that's a great point number one, is from our own immediate experience, that seems highly suspect. I would go even a step beyond that and say, if I'm the defender for God, if I'm the apologist for God, and I say, God built 10,000 people with completely free will, they could choose anything they want, and all 10,000 of them chose him. If I'm the devil's advocate on this one, if I've changed roles, I'm the devil's advocate now, I'd say, how on earth could I know that you haven't just secretly programmed them to do what you want? Because they all did what you want. All of them did what you want. So there's an interesting point, I think, about free will. Yes?
So one of the things Lewis said in his discovery of the Psalms early on was that he felt that God, in calling for praise to himself, he felt that God was sort of... he called it like a vain woman.
Right, right.
Sort of like, look at me, praise me, look at me. And he said he had trouble with that early on, but then eventually got to the idea that, like, well, what do you do when you eat a really, really good meal? Imagine that one meal that your mom cooks or something like that, and you haven't had it in years, you go back, and you... I remember us eating something at the beach, my dad had made some steak and just, like... bent over into it, like, oh, this is so...
Can't even stop eating it, right?
You're just naturally praising it because it's good, it's praiseworthy, you know? And so he kind of got to the level of, well, God is asking us to praise him because he is as good as the best meal, he is as beautiful as the most beautiful vista, he is as... And these are just mere shadows of who he is, and it's good for us to praise him, right? So in that line of thinking, it wouldn't be impossible for God to go... look at me with true eyes and have everybody look at him and go, now, whether that's realistic and we see it, no, not, but it would be possible for God to create a world in which he opened everybody's eyes to actually see how truly beautiful he was and to have everybody go, yeah, no, that's, wow, he needs to be worshipped right now.
So I do think that, I think there's something to this. In fact, I'll go a step further on it and say something like this. For God to say to people, I'm somebody that you should pay attention to, and I'm the greatest of all beings. That's not vainglorious. That's simply the facts. So I think of somebody like, imagine that you're a 100-meter dash runner, and you want to become an Olympic champion, and you go to a camp, and here's this gentleman of African, apparently African extraction with a cool accent, and he says to you, all right, let me tell you how to do this. And he gives you a whole bunch of weird things. I want you to run with a parachute, then I want you to do this, and I want you to take 3 days off. And you're finally like, who are you and why should I care about? And he's like, I'm Usain Bolt. And you're like, I don't know that name. And he's like, well, really, you don't know, I'm the fastest man alive. You know, he's not wrong to say that. What he's trying to do is say, my authority, and Usain Bolt's authority might be derivative of the fact that he's incredibly fast and probably ought to know how to go fast. Maybe he's just amazingly genetically gifted, but... probably more than that, right? So for God to say, you know, in the garden, for somebody to say, why should we listen to God? The answer is, I made all of this, including you. If anybody knows what it is to make you gonna make you happy, it's me. So now the only question is, do you trust me that what I'm telling you is the best way to be happy? The serpent turns around and says, does God really say basically that's the best way for you to be happy? You shouldn't listen to that guy. You should listen to me. And in the most bonehead moment of at least the first couple chapters there, we're like, yeah, why trust God? Why not trust this serpent? Okay. Let me add something to this, or continue down the path I was headed down a little bit too. While it's not wrong for God to say, look at me and worship me, that is a tangential point. One of the major points that I'm trying to make is, if every one of your wills in here, if it's truly free, the degree of freedom that it has, and for the engineers in the room, you know what we mean by this. Degrees of freedom are how many directions can it move? So 6 degrees of freedom means it can move in all 6 directions, which are the 3 dimensions kind of in all ways, including rotation and stuff like that. So can you choose any of them equally without restraint? Whose will is like that? Well, God's will is like that. He can choose anything that he wants without restraint. But if he creates any other free will, truly libertarian free will, every one of those wills is equally as valent, is equally capable of choosing left, right, fore, or aft as God's will is. So I don't want to underscore this one. Everybody's, let me illustrate what I mean by this, and then you can tell me whether you disagree. Everybody's will is as powerful as God's. Not everybody's power is as powerful as God's. Don't forget that there's a difference between having a free will and being omnipotent. Omnipotent means he has the power to do everything. He can actualize anything that he wills. Having free will simply means you're not constrained by some outside programming force or puppet strings. Go ahead.
There has to be some kind of qualitative difference between the will of God and the knowledge of God and the human. I'm a bug.
So there is. There is a difference between his knowledge and yours. But that's not part of will. Will acts on knowledge. So maybe what you could say is this. God knows all the different colors. So he could choose any one of them. But let's pretend for a second that God shows you all the colors that are out there. That he allows you to see everything in the electromagnetic spectrum, because that's where colors are, from just barely moving waves all the way up to it'll kill you past gamma radiation type of stuff. But that you could see all those colors. And then he says, choose them. Is there any limitation on which color you choose? Do you even think of how that would function? How would it be the case that you couldn't choose 4,000 or 4 terahertz as the frequency of...
There's no limitation on the will, and that's where my argument is if God understands 100% of knowledge and I understand 0.6%, then I'm very limited in what my will can even choose.
But you do see that it's not a limitation on the will, it's a limitation on the knowledge on which the will is acting. Okay, and that's all I mean to say. That distinction is fine and proper. I'm not saying you knew everything. I'm saying of the things that you do know, you are completely capable of choosing any of them.
Could God change my will by giving me different knowledge?
If he, could he change your will? No. Could it be that what you will do will change based on what he shows you? Now, if you have libertarian free will and God says to you this, you can choose any of these 3 colors, red, blue, or yellow. Is that right? Red, blue, yellow. Yes. Those are the primary colors? It's been a long time. Kindergarten. Got to reach deep for that one. And you're like, oh, okay, well, I like blue. Right. Now, instead, God's, let's pretend he didn't give you the primary colors. He gave you, hey, you can have red, blue, yellow, or green. And you, in that case, I choose green. So in that case, you could say, God changed your will. No, he didn't change your will. What he did was he presented you a different set of choices, and you freely chose green over blue. That is to say, if you had the option of green, you would have chosen green. But if you didn't have the option of green, you would have chosen blue. Now remember, this is not a limitation on will. It wasn't that presenting green caused you to be unable to choose blue. All it did was you opted to choose this other one. So now this is very, very important what you're talking about, because it is the basis of how somebody who believes in, you know, Molinism or middle knowledge is going to justify their belief. They're going to say, well, God can still somehow bring it about. And you, the philosophers will use the phrase bring it about, because I don't know, I guess it's the broadest way to think of it. I disagree. I think there's a current debate right now between Arthur Cunningham and William Hasker in Faith and Philosophy. And Hasker's an open theist and Cunningham is a Molinist. And they're going at it, and they're back and forth. And when you read the last guy's one, you're like, yeah, that guy's right, and the other guy's wrong. And the next guy comes out, and you're like, no, that guy's right, and the next one's wrong. They say it this way. They say, and I'll skip past the X and A and C, because it's just confusing and dumb, and I don't know why we do it that way. Just I guess to make, some people say the philosopher's greatest fear is that he'll be well understood. So they say, God can bring it about and I'm just, they put, you know, X and C and all this other stuff that I'm just going to say Timmy and Freddie are my two guys that always do everything. That Timmy chooses to, we'll say Timmy chooses blue, since we've been using that example. That's the way that they put it. And the debate happens around what you think can happen there. I actually think this is the wrong way to frame it. I don't think that that is an accurate statement. I think what happens is God can bring it about that Timmy exists, and Timmy bring it about that Timmy chooses blue. Now, this seems a little convoluted, but I think it's necessary to talk about it in as many terms as this, because it is not the case that Timmy can choose blue absent God, and it's not the case that God can have Timmy choose blue absent Timmy, and it's not the case that the word choose here is meaningful if Timmy's choice is programmed. Do you know what I mean? It is a joint effort. It is in logical terms, it is an and relationship. It is a conjunction. You have to have both terms there for it to be true. So in order for, you know, A and B, you know, that's a logical phrase, to be considered the value true, both A and B have to be true. A disjunction, A or B, if either one of those are true, it can be true. So this is not a disjunction, this is a conjunction.
Grigham calls that concurrence in this systematic theology.
Yes, so if concurrence is the word that means, to your mind, that God and Timmy are both necessary in order for that statement to be true, that's what I'm trying to get across. So the reason that I think that we're mired in some controversy about this right here is because it's simply the wrong way to talk about it. It takes this phrase right here and it automatically makes it deterministic, because it's God that can do this. But this choice right here belongs to this guy. So now the bring it about is what we're really saying is, well, what we mean by bring it about is he knew that he would choose blue or green, or he would choose green if he presented the choice. He doesn't want him to choose green, he wants him to choose blue, so God just doesn't give him the green choice. And so Timmy chooses blue. So God brought it about that Timmy chooses blue. You're missing the part of Timmy's will in there. So something to keep in mind. This is, by the way, lest anybody get too mired in this, let me point... Yes, sir. Yeah.
I have a question that Randy's hand's been up for a while.
Oh, yeah, sorry. He's hiding back there.
So I think what Kevin put it best, he used the phrase, open your eyes. And so for me, and maybe this... I think a premise that should be in there is that God would reveal himself in the most maximum way. In the greatest of ways. Okay. The maximally great being would reveal himself in the greatest of ways. It seems hard for me to look at the world and to say, this is the greatest possible way that God could reveal himself to Timmy, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a theodicy for it, but it seems that there are, you know, if we're using choose red, blue, or green, God could give Timmy a choice between red, blue, or green. And he can also give Timmy a choice between red, blue, and green. But really pick red, because red's the best color and you should really, really pick this. And so that, yes, Timmy can pick any of the other ones, but really he has no other reason to pick red because it's so apparently obvious that red is the best choice.
So let me give an example of this one right here. And let's imagine God is really good. And so what he's going to do is he's not going to make this terribly complex, right? He's not going to say, listen, here's how I want the world to go. Here's what I want you to do. What I want you to do is I want you to go down here, and then once you go down here, I want you to turn left. But after you turn left, you're going to make two rights. And don't miss the second right, because if you miss the second right, you'll have gone to the third right and fourth left, and that fourth left is a bad thing, and I want you to do that. So I want... This is complex.
problems.
Yeah, it sounds really hard to do. What's the easiest way to do it? Is to give somebody the simplest possible choice. What's the simplest possible choice? Two options, or the option of A or not A, right? So the options, the simplest options are one of two, depending on how you want to think about it. Either choose this or anything other than that, or choose either A or B. That's the simplest choice you can give. So imagine, you know, you're proposing to your wife at some, your to-be wife, and you say to her, you know, I love you very much, I want you to marry me, but I only want you to marry me in the case that that's really what you prefer, and if what's your preference, if you forecast in the future is correct, then, and you don't think that you'll love somebody greater than you would love me, then I want you to love, you don't say that, right? The choice is simple. I want to love you forever, I will give myself to you. Do you accept me is really the question, or will you make the same commitment back to me, maybe is the other question. So if God's going to give it the simplest possible way, then he's got to give you the choice between good and evil. But what's the problem of giving somebody a choice between evil, or loving him or not loving him? What's the problem between the choice in good and evil? Because we're talking about moral choices here. Often if you give somebody an evil choice, what do we call that?
Temptation.
So God can't provide temptation because that might actually tempt you to do something wrong. Another way of putting it is if God is only going to give you the right solution, because it fulfills his purpose as a recommended course of action, then for him to outline another one, cleverly enough, might make it seem tempting. Skylar, you have an objection already.
I feel like there's a story towards the front of the Bible, somewhere maybe in the first chapter, where God does lay out some temptation specifically for people.
Dude, call spoiler alert if you're going to say this. Okay.
Sorry, everybody.
Here's how many ways, are there more ways to be good or ways to be bad? Do you think?
There's more ways to do that.
Okay, let's say we take what Skylar has to say. There's one good way. Yeah. And let's say there's all these bad ways out there. So can God... Yeah, a narrow path and a wide path. Maybe we use that as some biblical evidence that maybe that's the case. So what God wants to say then isn't... Because imagine he presented the case to Eve and Adam. I want you to exist in this garden... Everything's here that you need. And just listen to me. Trust me. Okay? Trust me. That's this one. However, if you don't want to trust me, then I need you to be careful of this tree. And then I also need you to be careful of, Adam, I don't want you to hit Eve. Adam's like, what do you mean? What is hit Eve? Well, hit is when you take your hand and you smack her in the face. Now, Adam wasn't even thinking of this one. Now it's smack her in the face. Or alternate, maybe not something as egregious. Maybe, Adam, what I don't want you to do is look at some other tree and say, that apple's better than that apple, and if I eat that one, then Eve won't be able to have that one available, so she'll have to eat that one, and I want it, I don't want her to have it. Now, all of a sudden, Adam's like, I wasn't even thinking about which apple was better. I was just there to satisfy my hunger, but now I'm going to think about it. So now he's provided temptation. So he actually can't tell them what not to do because he provides temptation by telling them what not to do. What he would have to do is something like this. Group all of this in one group to make it a simple choice, and he would have to characterize it in such a way that it's not a temptation. How would he do that? This right here, to your point earlier, is knowledge. There's a lot of knowledge in here. Knowledge of things that don't help. There's actually a lot of knowledge in here. There's more knowledge in here than there is in here, but who's responsible for the knowledge on the good side? If what God says was this, if the one good thing is this, trust me, then God's responsible for all the knowledge. If you don't say, trust me, if you say, trust yourself, then who's responsible for all getting all that knowledge? You are. And you got to get it from whatever sources that you're going to get it from, including crafty serpents or whatever else they are. So hold on, I see the skepticism, but one eye is skeptical and the other one's not. So I'm going to speak to the eye that's not skeptical. If God turns around and makes this a true bivalent decision, the only way to do it is to say this. Start them off innocent and say, you have two choices. Trust what I tell you to do because I created you and I'm the one that knows all this stuff and I care about your happiness. Or alternately, you can make the choices yourself. What are the choices? You won't know those unless you choose to not trust me, in which case then you will know them. What would we call that? Knowledge of good and evil. So what God, the choice God presented them was not, here's good and here is evil. The choice he presented them was, here's me telling you what to do and you trust me, or you being responsible for it entirely yourself. So you'll notice, by the way, who was cursed? Was Adam cursed?
The ground was cursed.
The ground was cursed. The serpent was cursed. Eve gets a tougher time having children and kind of gets put underneath the husband, it seems. What about Adam? The earth was cursed, but Adam wasn't cursed.
He just got banned. He didn't get cursed.
He got banned, right. And the earth got cursed.
Right, so mankind was cursed because death is now...
So, now that's the hot ticket. Was mankind always immortal? Or was he only immortal because he had access to the tree of life? So, at least in the Genesis story, the implication appears to say something like, it's access to the tree of life that makes you immortal, that you're not inherently immortal. So remember what God says is to his himself or to his heavenly court, more likely, is we must not let man, now that he knows, eyes are open and he knows good from evil, take from the tree of life, lest he live forever, because God knows how this is going to go. With all these choices out here and without the knowledge, and now he's not listening to God, he said, I want to do it all myself. God knows he's going to mess it up. So he can't live forever, because if he lives forever, he's got way too much capacity to do too much bad. We're so limited in our capacity, it's really hard for us to do, maybe not that hard, but hard for us to do really, really true, terrible, terrible evil and as bad as it could be, because we're limited to 120 years of trying to do evil, and we're pretty weak for the last bits of those. So bottom line on this one, and then to Kevin's point, bottom line on this one, God's most loving choice was, you can either trust me or not, which one do you want to do? And that's love. That's the choice of love. To love God is to trust him, in the same way that to love your wife is to trust your wife. That's part of it. It's not all of it, but it's part of it. You cannot love somebody that you don't trust. Because the bivalent love relationship is to believe and trust that the other person is going to love you back. That's the point. You wouldn't get married to somebody that you're like, I'm going to love this person, but the chance that they're going to love me back is practically zero. Right? That you can do that, but it is a unidirectional love. It is not bidirectional love, and I'm talking about bidirectional love. Kevin and then Scott.
This makes a lot of sense in Ecclesiastes. Some of what seems like nonsense that it's all about, like the more wise you are, the more suffering and depressed you are.
Yeah, because we gain our wisdom not in the godly way of doing it. If we gained it, I actually think God would have opened up all these amazing things that we are so proud of now, of scientific accomplishments and all that kind of stuff. This would have all been there too. I think that would have been the optimal utopian plan. The difference is we punted on listening to the best architect, engineer, designer, and theoretician out there, Skyler.
But I think that was, you talk about like the middle knowledge and molded, that was going to happen. Like the idea that there was this choice, and there's a version of the Bible that's really short. It's like, one chapter, and we never ate the fruit. Like that seems... It seems ridiculous on its face. So it seems like this is a foregone conclusion, and the relationship that Adam and Eve had in the garden, when you describe it,
yep.
And you say, well, it was this loving, perfect, beautiful relationship, except they had no knowledge of good and evil. Like, it was a dumb relationship. It was a simple, simple relationship. It was a simple, simple world. And I think when you say things like, well, all the knowledge of, it seems to me that love requires evil and tragedy and heartache to exist in the world.
So I've got a reason that you think that. Hold on, hold that thought, okay. Because the data are going to explain that, I think. But in the meantime, let me interject one thing and say, the simple world is not a bad world, because imagine it this way. Adam's in the garden. He's walking around and he's just having a great time, right? He's naming animals: giraffe, hippopotamus, buffalo, water buffalo, giraffe. Did I already say giraffe? He's doing everything that is fun, and then he finally gets to this part of the river and he sees on the other side of the river another set of fruit he hasn't eaten before. He's like, I would like to try this fruit. He could look at the river, and God has hopefully programmed him to realize that this is a fast rushing river. If I jump in it, there's some non-zero probability that this could go badly for me. And so what does he do? Well, in the garden, he turns around to God and says, how am I supposed to... I like that fruit over there, God says. I built that fruit for you. He says, but there's this river in the way. God could be a good parent and say, You know, what you would do to your son. How would you get across the river? What's the problem? And he helps him problem solve his way through that one. So this ignorance that is so detestable to you is dispelled in the course of sitting under the greatest mentor of all time. That's who God is in the garden. God is the ultimate teacher, guru, mentor, God. All of the things that we want out of our parents, our teachers, our preachers. He's all of those right there. We don't need any of those things.
Except for knowledge of good and evil.
But again...
Except for knowledge of good and evil.
Right. Now, why would... What? How does... Well, okay. Hold on to that, and you'll see whether the rest of this makes you happy or not. Okay. And Randy, and then Steve. Okay. And then Kevin.
So, I guess my... Maybe I'm glad when I can provide a route for you to get to what you want to talk about.
Good, thank you.
Maybe I just didn't make a good bridge to what I was discussing, which is, my problem is revelation. Like, my objection is more along the lines of, like, this seems like a very, like, you said it, or you said that you can't love someone you can't trust.
Right.
And so, the amount, when I look at the world, the level of evidence to trust God looks like that note that you wrote on there. Like, it kind of is like, there's a little sticky note on the fridge that says, trust me.
Right.
When, like, God could show up and be like, hey, I'm God. Like, right. Write his name in the sky and, be our, at the expense of making him a pony. But, like, basically, if you really love someone, you reveal yourself a lot better than the way it's revealed in the world today.
Okay. Now, the quick counterpoint to this is a great point. And a lot of people bring this one up. Now, you got to believe the Bible for this to make sense.
Okay.
So for this particular evidence to make sense. Where did God most powerfully reveal himself in the Bible?
Exodus,
right? It's replete with God doing unbelievable, miraculous destruction of the Egyptian army, which is one of the powerhouses of the time. Pillar of fire, pillar of smoke, water out of rocks. Come on. What was the almost universal experience of the people who saw all that stuff? Rejection of God. And you're like, what is wrong with these people? It's the same thing that's wrong with us. So I'll get to that point. And Steve.
This whole question about what is the best possible world?
Yeah.
I think it's pretty presumptuous that humans...
Okay, well,
how can you define what
I'm not saying we can know it. What I'm saying is, let me give you an example of what it might be. So let me finish, and then you can see whether you like it or not. So remember what I said at the beginning. I'm not saying this is the way that it is. I'm just giving you a possibility, and then you can decide based on your own intuition and then on the data that I'm going to provide you here quickly, whether or not you find it a good explanation. So I'm not saying this has to be the way that it is. I happen to think that it is, but I could be wrong about it, and we can point out the places where I might be wrong, but I'm not saying this has to be the way that it is.
I'm still thinking about how you said that God's will, or you equated man's will with God's will.
Yeah.
Is it true to say that the farther you go on the continuum to the right that you drew a couple weeks ago with Molinism and then
open theism.
I would think of it as God's will. Our will becomes more like God's will the farther right we go. But as you go to the left, past compatibilism, towards determinism, does our will become less like God's?
Yes. Well, so I think there's a line that you draw in there. Now I can't find where we drew this line. There it is. There's a line. Do I see the FW line there? That's the free will line. Everything to the right side of there has libertarian free will. Everything to the left side of there does not have libertarian free will. It's something other than that. So now compatibilism, remember I said, is supposed to kind of bridge over here. They're saying that that free will and determinism and sovereignty in a deterministic almost sense are compatible. But the idea is God's will, this is God-type will, and this is not God-type will. This is constrained on the left, this is unconstrained on the right.
So as we move forward, there might be a difference in understanding of what free will actually means.
Yeah, and so that's why I define it up front, and that free will that I'm talking about, for this to make any sense, to at least to make any sense to me, we have to be talking about it in the libertarian sense. And the libertarian sense is one that is unconstrained by anything other than knowledge, let's say. Anything other than knowledge. All right, Al, and then we got to get going.
Yeah,
to
I'm
finish.
Still hung up on that too. When God, before the universe existed, God was the only one that existed, anything that would be libertarian free will. When God created the universe, there was nothing outside of God that was influencing him any direction, no one that he needed to consult, no authoritative thing out there that he had to look at and say, okay, let's see if I can make the greatest possible world. And that was libertarian free will when he created the universe. And we make all of our decisions within that universe that he created, with the minds he gave, with the free will, the will, which you don't, we don't have the same viewpoint on that. But
well, let me ask this question. Do you think that it's logically possible that God could make a being that has will as free as his is? Will as free as his is. Not knowledge as great as his, not power as great as his, but will as free as his is free.
Well, at least the way I'm presenting it right now, no.
Right, that's exactly right.
We don't have the same freedom when we're... as God did when he created the universe.
Okay, so why do you think that our freedom is constrained? What is it that constrains it? Or let me put it to you this way. Let's say there are three, that you are sitting next to God on a panel, and somebody else presents you three choices. You can have cookies, cake, or ice cream, and only one of those. And he presents the same thing to God. Is there anything that prevents you from choosing any one of those three? Is there anything that prevents God from choosing any one of those three?
Well,
is there any difference between
just that? I mean, just that choice itself, but I'm being influenced by they're always...
You may be influenced for it. You may say to yourself, I'm really hungry for pie right now, but
yeah.
People are really hungry for stuff they don't eat all the time. So is there anything that makes you choose one of them or makes you not choose the other? Or are you capable of choosing any of them? Maybe you want one more than the other, but that's not a constraint on will.
Yeah.
That's a set of desires. The will, just because you desire one thing more than another doesn't mean that that is what your will has to do. That's determinism. Determinism says it is cause, and the effect is that your will responds to that cause. Free will says... nope, you can pick any of them. In fact, we frequently pick things that we don't desire as strongly as we desire the other ones. Now, we often turn around and say, well, we really desired that one more. Not in the moment we didn't, at any rate. We made an effort of will, we call it, in order to not do that thing. But I apologize in order to get the rest of this at least partially out, I'm going to have to hurry up. But hold on to that thought. We can talk about it in the hot wash for the end of this and next time, too. Okay. Maximizing the number of free moral beings who live in perfect love. So this is in response to the question of why can't God basically look out at the 100 people? Remember I said we create 100 people or 10,000 people and all of them go one way. I would be suspicious of the process if all of them go one way. In fact, what is the naive estimate? If will is truly free, if it's the case, if, suspend your disbelief, if it's the case that your will is as free as God's, and a bunch of people say, God says, choose me, trust me, or make your own choice. What would you expect? What number of wills of the 10,000 would you expect to go either way? Well, what's the naivest possible estimate? The naivest possible estimate is there's two choice. These wills are completely free. Half of them choose to love God. Half of them say, I'll take a pass and do it my own way. 50-50. That's the naive estimate. Now, we will let other things inform that, but that's the naive estimate. Why can't you just pick the 5,000? Why, if that was the case, if of 10,000 people, God was going to create them all, and 5,000 are going to choose to live in perfect love, and 5,000 are going to choose to do their own thing, why not just create the 5,000? Well, if it's the greatest number as a ratio, a percentage, you can't do that and have the best possible world, and here's why. There are four, I've changed my categories for those that have heard this before, there are four categories of how beings can respond. One, beings that will love perfectly in any event. They always do the right thing. Two, beings that would love perfectly only in a perfect world. You put me in utopia, I'll always make the right choice. Three, beings that would choose to love perfectly only in an imperfect world. Only if it's broken and I see the consequences of my actions. I'm curious, like Eve. I want to know. Then you find out, like Eve, and you say, ooh, not as good a deal as I thought. I'd prefer back to go back to option A. That's the third category of people. That one should sound familiar to you. The last one, people that doesn't matter what's going on, they're never going to choose the right thing. Who's my lead candidate for four? I don't. Has anybody ever seen this, Four Eyes? This is a weird way that Word has decided to do this now. That beings that have seen God in all of his power and glory and still don't want to do it. Anybody, any names you would throw up as somebody who would do that? Satan, Lucifer. Okay, that he was like, this guy is really worthy of worship. I would like that place. I want to take that step. So it's not a failure to recognize how awesome God is. It's a desire to be even more awesome than God is. Bad choice. Okay. So I'm going to skip the greatest possible world, blah, 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 because I say the same thing very more simply here. There must be a pre-utopian world where those category three people, the people that need to see the evil, feel the evil, touch the evil, whatever else, to know that that was a bad option, to never make that choice again. I'll put it this way to you. You who are Christians in here, if God put the tree of the knowledge of good and evil back in the center of heaven, would you ever eat from it again? Would you? Knowing what it'll cost? No. I mean, the whole point of being a Christian, one of the points of being a Christian is you don't decide to do that anymore. What you say is, you know what? I've tested it. God is always better. I'm going to do what God recommends to do.
That's the difference. You already have it. You've already come from.
You're making my point, brother. You're making my point. So hold on and let me show you. Let me show you. You have the knowledge. You have the knowledge. Right. There's only one way to get that.
So there's no temptation to eat the food.
There's only one way to get that, and that's experience.
Right.
Okay, but remember, there's four categories of people. So imagine Adam, Eve, Bob, and Sue. Bob and Sue, if you put them in this is my family, those are my parents' friends. I don't know, I guess that's where that came from. Bob and Sue, they probably would not have made this choice. Bob and Sue get put in the Garden of Eden. God says, do it my way, but if you want to do it your way, here's this tree. Bob and Sue say this. Oh, okay, well that sounds like a bad idea. We're never touching that tree. It's Skylar's shortest possible Bible. And they all lived happily ever after.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But God says that's not sufficient. Why doesn't that world work based on what I just told you? Why does that world not work? Because if they are the father and mother of the 5,000, there are a part of that other 5,000, the bad 5,000, there's a part of those that don't make it. They never get either created or they don't make it at all to heaven. Why? Because they had to see evil in order to do it, in order to choose the right things. Here are those four things graphed crudely on either side of a utopian line. Yes?
What's wrong with not being created as a outcome?
So I can only think of a couple of things. One, people might still remain suspicious of like, really? Everybody chose you and nobody dissented at all? And the other one is it greater? So maybe a Pharisee, and the prostitute comes in and washes her feet with washes his feet with her tears and dries them with her hair and pours costly perfume on his feet. Jesus says to Simon, I think it was the guy's name, forgives one guy 5 talents and another 500. Who loves him more? The one who was forgiven more. So here's this woman whose love will be deeper in her case than it would have been otherwise because she went through this stuff. And so it's a deeper love that comes out of that one. Maybe that's a justification. Maybe you don't like that one. There's more to be said on this topic, but you ask, in my opinion, this is the best question against this system right here, is do you have to have any of the bad people? Why not just have the 5,000 and have less? Well, I think, so there's a longer analysis that goes into that one, but in the interest of time, let me skip it for now, and we can follow up with this one too. But let's say here's this pre-utopia and utopia. You've got three classes of beings. Those top two arrows are people who will always be good in any scenario. So remember, there's evil in this pre-utopian world. Do you have to subject any of these always good beings to evil? Maybe not. Maybe all of them could be only created once utopia is there, once The world is perfect again. Eventually good beings. This, by the way, would be all of us. If you're Christians, this is you. Eventually good beings, people that had experienced evil in order to turn around and say, I don't want to do that anymore. Personal testimonies are terrific in this vein. Think of your own personal testimonies. That may be something for you. There's an interesting class that I had forgotten about. They're only good in utopia. These are people that if tempted would fall, but if they see evil would fall, but if they don't even have it as an option, they're only good in utopia. There may be people like that. Maybe there aren't any people like that, but maybe there are people like that. And then there's people who are always bad. This is Satan and his gang, and maybe other people too. They're always bad beings, but you can't have any of them in utopia. So that the end of that arrow, by the way, is a termination line. All those got to go somewhere else or get destroyed or whatever it is, or not be created in the first place. Okay, so that's how it would kind of graph out. Let's go back here. Here's my hypothesis then, based on this thinking. The world in which we find ourselves could be this pre-utopian world. This is the arena world, the filtering world, the world where those who will eventually be good learn to be good in the long run. What is the naive estimate of the percentages? Well, I think there are three classes of beings. Always good, contingently good, or contingently bad. That is, it depends on the experience as to whether they'll be good or bad. And then always bad. So the naive estimate's 33%. You know, maybe that might not be right. I'm just saying that's the naive estimate. The pre-utopian world contains the contingently good, maybe the always bad, or all of the always bad, and some, maybe, or none, probably smaller number of always good beings. Maybe there's some good people in here. Maybe our candidates for this one are as short a list as who's the guy that was first to go to heaven without dying? Enoch and Elijah. Maybe those are our two guys. Maybe it's nobody other than that. Maybe the Bible does describe an awful lot of righteous people. Job went through a lot of bad stuff and still didn't sin. So is Job one of those possible? Is it Daniel? Maybe. You know, Elizabeth? I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe nobody. Okay, now what is the purpose of evil? On this model, this is the purpose of evil. To convince the contingently good to be good. Those who need to try disobedience get to do so. Those who need to observe disobedience get to do so. To demonstrate to the always bad that they are bad. So, James, if in order to, maybe it's the case that you have to create all 10 people in order for their wills to become valent, in order for their wills to be actual. So I want to say that's the case. I want to say that talking about a potential will without creating a potential will, the eventuality of creating a potential will is meaningless because it's deterministic at that point. If God can know it without even potentially creating it, then it doesn't exist. Now the question is, do you have to actually create it in order to have that potential out there? All right, further discussion, but let's leave it for now just to identify the question. But if imagine that you were going to create all these wills and you're going to look at the good guys and you're going to be like, you know what? You don't have to try it. You're going to be good. They're like, okay, that's great to learn. The contingently good. They look at all of us and God's like, you're going to go, you'd mess up, but eventually you'd come around. And we'd be like, yeah, that's right. We'd come around. And he looks over at, you guys are in trouble. Sorry about this. He looks over at this group and he says, you guys are never going to get it right. You're all going to reject me. And so, by the way, you're going to hell. Or I'm going to destroy you.
Have a nice day.
Have a nice day. What are every one of these people going to say? Whoa, 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 whoa. What is this extrajudicial process? I want a lawyer. I would like to have a shot at this one. You'd have to convince them that they were going to be bad, I think. I don't think if some God created me and was like, by the way, you're going to be bad, I'm going to wink you right back out of existence. I'd be like, hey, man, come on. Can you cut me a break? Let me at least try it and show you.
Do you really think that bad people know they're bad people because they live in the world and go, I am one of the bad people.
No, I think they know this at the judgment.
Okay.
Well, I'm thinking I'm the bad people.
But I think they're
here. And what about these people who are responsible for making sure that I know their data points?
Say it again.
I'm part of the bad people, yep, over here, but what part of responsibility is it there is that I know all the data points?
That you know all what data points?
The data points that you presented.
But we're always
here. The fact that...
I'm moving.
I like the grain is fine.
The fact that, you know, God says that they're responsible, too, for teaching us and teaching our children. And because, you know, you look at a child who wants to climb the counter to get into the pills.
Yeah.
You're going to let him do it?
Yeah, right. No.
No.
Right.
there are people over here who say, these guys have limited brains. We need to educate them a little.
But I'm not saying that's the case. I'm saying you're co-living in another world. In fact, you may never come into contact with any of these people. It may be the case that you don't. But the bottom line is the temptation that these people are going to experience is either evil that they generate themselves or it's coming from you.
And all those that are saved with the maximal love that they have over here are just going to ignore the fact that we exist?
The idea is you cannot exist in love with somebody that rejects you. And you guys over here...
Are they going to stop pushing? Are they going to stop teaching? Are they going to stop knocking at my door?
Yeah, you guys are gone.
Oh, they make the judgment?
So God's not... They make it through the judgment. You don't make it through the judgment.
They don't know.
You're saying this is the final finality.
Yes.
The world going on as we speak.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So there is no obligation.
Right. We're already...
This is a subset of the
in that little warm area.
Okay. Yeah, yes, that's right. Or you're on the way there now.
Okay.
All right, so let me run through it very quickly. I'm about to skip some other objections, and then we'll do some more in a second. Okay, now by the way, if part of demonstrating the bad people it's always bad, consider this. The problem of gratuitous evil then goes away. There's no gratuitous. Gratuitous means purposeless evil. There is no purposeless evil on this model. If it's all evidence to convince, like you said, to convince these people that aren't going to be like, I'm bad, but when it all gets showed up in court compared to all the way that it ought to be, they either do one of two things that we see in real courtrooms, right? The person's guilty and they know it and they try everything they can to minimize or whatever else, or they defiantly shake their hands and say, I'm still right, all of you are wrong. We usually call those people crazy or psychotic. But it may be people who just deny it entirely. In any case, those people got to go. But what has that evil done? It has convinced these people around here that there are, in fact, people that will never see it the right way and have to not be part of that utopia.
There's kind of a third option, which is when confronted at
yes.
the end,
yes.
I say, I was wrong and I beg forgiveness.
And you know what? It may be the case. I mean, this is, to my knowledge, not Christian doctrine. I mean, but it may be the case that repentance at the judgment is allowed.
Right.
But I don't see biblical evidence for that one. But that maybe. But maybe.
Well, I mean,
the preaching, Jesus going and preaching to the dead, that type of thing, the people who are in prison, that idea that we kind of skip a lot here, that is something in that direction.
But the thief on the cross is a close analogy.
That's right. That's right. And so, I mean, in that case, though, those would be. The type of people, this would be the conditionally good.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So I want to get to the data real quick now that I've got 1 minute left. Can we stay till 10:20? Does anybody object to do that?
I object.
Object. Overruled. There's a motion. Is there a second? Yeah? Okay. This is what we would predict. If there is no gratuitous evil and this is a pre-utopian, something like 33% of the population would be opposed to listening to God, even if they know the consequence. Something like 33% of the population wouldn't be exposed to evil at all. Remember, these are the people that don't need to be exposed, or contingently good people, only if they're in utopia. Some of the remaining population would learn to trust the all-loving, all-good creator. And I said, this is a naive estimate again, even a naive estimate on top of a naive estimate. Something like half of those who reached moral decision-making capability would willing to consider living in utopia at all. All right, so here's the data. I did 1,000 respondents, had 6 questions. 3 of them were data-bearing questions. 3 of them were quality control questions, just to make sure I wasn't getting bots or I wasn't getting somebody just, you know, A, B, B, C, B, C, B, C kind of thing down the thing. What did I do with it? Here it is. Question 1. If a loving God exists and that God tells you to do something, should you do so in every case? If a loving God exists and he tells you to do something, should you do so in every case? 40% of people said no. 59% of people said yes. Let's put a Qualtrics survey, Mechanical Turk operators. If you were in the biblical Garden of Eden, would you eat the fruit if it would give you the knowledge of good and evil? Even if God had told you not to gain the knowledge of good and evil, would you eat it? Even if God told you not to, 37% said, "Yeah, I'd do it."
Was there that country song, "If you're gonna be dumb, you gotta be tough"?
Yeah, that was playing in the background when they made the selection there. Isn't this amazing? If you were in the Garden of Eden and you knew the stakes, would you do it again? 37% of people, if you drop them into the new heaven and the new earth, would do it again. You want to know why the world's messed up? There's part of it right there. We're part of it too, but there's part of it right there. This one to me was the most amazing of the questions. Would you rather live in a world with no evil, but which you have to obey a good authority all the time, or would you rather live in a world with evil, but you can choose to do whatever you want? Half of the respondents, 48.16%, said, I would rather live in a world that has evil in it rather than have to say yes to somebody no matter how good they are. What?
I think that you, maybe the framing of your question or kind of the way you describe it, when it sounds like, you know, love is the greatest of all virtues, but there is a something sacred to free will and to being able to decide for yourself and choosing for yourself, even if you choose obedience. So, like, there's kind of a... If it sounds like you are being forced into obedience, that's something that is very, very... We're instinctively pushed back against that. So, I don't...
So, I tried to word this in which you must choose to obey a good authority, or which you always choose to obey a good authority. There was nothing where that didn't imply at least some question in there. So, yeah, these questions were crafted to be as minimally suggestive as they could be, but this is still how it turned out.
I wonder on your point, there was a guy that used to go to our church in Charlotte who's a professor of New Testament ethics. He taught this class, and he was kind of telling me about it, and I couldn't grab onto what the actual meat of the class was, but he said, freedom is the only ethic that the American church cares anything about. It kind of like blew my mind a little bit, and I wanted to dig into it more because I'm like, would a middle ages church have been like, no, we must have the freedom to choose. Like, if you live in a serfdom, you know, like you're like, no, this is where I'm at.
The reason we have that ethic is this world has an awful lot of people, especially in the church, who are the contingently good. The reason you feel that way, the reason that it's a strongly, intuitively compelling to you, is that's who you are. You are these people. So you would expect to see it that way. That's what you would expect from the American church. You would expect people who are like, no, we have to have seen how it was. Well, that's, of course you think that way. That's who you are. So look at this, though. Naive estimate is 33% of each. And what did we actually see? People who, even if God was in charge, I wouldn't want to do it. 37%, 33% was a naive estimate. Eventually, good beings come out to be about 33% of it. Where are all the good people? Where are the good ones, though?
Not taking surveys on the internet.
Not taking surveys on the internet. You know why they're not taking surveys on the internet? Maybe. Mm-hmm. I'll show you why. John Hopkins Manual for Gynecology and Obstetrics and the National Institute for Health have these following two studies. Among females who know they're pregnant, the miscarriage rate is 10 to 20%. But that's not how many actually. You know, chemical pregnancies happen in the first 5 weeks. They're often noted as not noted at all or noted as heavy periods or something like that. The estimate by modern science is that 30 to 50% of all fertilizations end in miscarriage. Do you believe that life begins at conception? Where are those babies? That is 30 to 50% of the population of humanity is gone before they even show up in the world. Is it the case that they're there because they're these people? Do babies go to heaven? Well, if so, they can't be the eventually good beings. They can't be contingently good. They must be the good ones. They could be the contingent. They could be these contingently good. And they might be those. Don't forget the babies. They're 30 to 50% of humanity. Very interesting, right? Now, if you don't believe that life begins at conception, different data. But if you do, and I think most of the people in here do, those are data that you're going to want to deal with. Interestingly, they make these numbers, the survey numbers, and those numbers align relatively closely with the naive estimate of what free will, truly libertarian free will, would cause the world to look like. Now, I realize I've given you a whole bunch of data in a very short time, and I haven't given you enough time to ask questions. chew on this one. I'll send it out. I'm trying to figure out how to send these things out. They're not doing very well. But I'll send these out as well. Look at them this week. I need your feedback for next week, because ultimately, if this is any good, if we test it and it's compelling at all, this is one of the things that we want to turn into some sort of video or media product, along with the Trinity kind of thing, along with other stuff that you guys come up with. So please give me as much of this thought as you can, because it would be very, very valuable to us. And then, of course, if this is wrong, it's good to see it so we don't teach it anymore. But if it's right, doesn't it seem to make a lot of sense if it's right? And so I need, especially guys who have really good reason to be opposed to it. If you're starting off as a compatibilist and your idea of free will is not as libertarian as this one, then there's another discussion that has to go on. But these are I'm very interested in everyone's opinion on this one. All right, sorry that took longer than I thought, but it was because of good interaction. We'll do some more of this next week, and then we'll hop back into our study after that. Thank you for your time.